Welcome back to Around the Wheel with Brett Tax. And my guest today is Jesse Pacht. And this is a topic that I am extremely passionate about. And I'm going to let Jesse introduce himself, and I'll bet you can figure out what we're going to be chatting about. Jesse?
So I've been an adventure rider for about 6 or 7 years now, maybe a little bit longer. Started out on as a street rider about 20 years before that. And when I started adventure riding, I realized that there was sort of a lack of first aid knowledge, that we have all engaged in this very dangerous outdoor sport, but not many of us are prepared to take care of each other if we get hurt in the woods. And it's something that I've been very passionate about since we've started doing this. And as adventure riding in general has become very popular and is still the fastest growing segment of motorcycling, I think it's more important now than ever that we all become very well versed in wilderness first aid whenever we go out on the trails.
I teach the adventure training and the adventure camps, and there are three of my top topics that we discuss when we're not on the motorcycle. On the motorcycle, it's fun. You know, we get on and we ride. That's what we all think about when we're out riding, but we don't think about what happens if. And it's the mechanics of how to fix your tire, how to fix your bike if you punch a hole in the case, which is certainly important and can be life-threatening, but generally isn't. There's just knowing where you are, a lack of the ability to navigate. Riders just, they download stuff to their phone or potentially to their GPS and they head off, but they really don't know how to navigate the outdoors. But the one that I'm always really concerned about is exactly what you're bringing up. People go out and they take a basic first aid class with the fire department or the Red Cross, which essentially just says if it doesn't breathe, blow in it. And if it bleeds, plug the hole and then call 911 and wait for help. And that just doesn't seem to be a really good plan if we're out in the backwoods or if we're traveling internationally.
Yeah. In most of those cases, if we are properly trained and we have the right equipment with us and the right skill set, then we can take care of 90% of those issues on the trail, possibly saving somebody's life, but certainly stabilizing people until the pros get there.
One of the challenges that I run into is I'm often the one that people look to if something happens. I've become an expert at mitigating injuries and preventing them because I don't want to use the stuff that I bring in my aid bag or my medic bag. And I do a really good job of having to throw a lot of stuff away. And I'm very happy about that. But we do need to know how to use this. And I think what we forget often is even if we're in the United States or we're in Canada or we're in Europe where we're close to hospitals, we seem to think that somebody's going to just drive up the trail and pick you up, or some helicopter is going to swoop you in and pull you out, and you're going to be in the hospital in no time at all. And that's really not the reality.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of places, even in the American West, where you're a long way from anywhere. When we did the TAT last year, it was myself and one other rider, and there were multiple times where we were 30, 40 miles from nothing in the middle of Nevada and Utah. And thank goodness, neither of us got seriously hurt for that whole trip. But it definitely goes through your mind when you're in the middle of nowhere. What's going to happen?
You do this professionally. In my background, I've done and taught a lot of first aid, first responder type of stuff for civilians. And also, I was an EMT years and years ago. And what I found is that those skills that I learned doing first aid, those skills I learned as an EMT are nice. But when I was an EMT, I had lots of toys. And my job was to package people up and drop them off where somebody really knew what they were doing. And first aid, as we mentioned, is just kind of plugging the holes until help can arrive. But you teach wilderness first aid, and that's why you're on the show today. What makes that so different? And why do motorcyclists, why do riders need to have different training than regular first aid? And what do you do different?
It's that access. It's exactly what you said, Brett. It's that access to immediate help. And wilderness first aid teaches us, first and foremost, situational awareness. It teaches you when you come upon an accident scene, when you come upon an incapacitated rider, it teaches you to look around and assess the situation. Is the danger still there? What happened to this person? And you take a breath and you step back before you jump in. They teach us to put on our gloves, assess the situation, and then start assessing the patient. Then you go through you follow the ABCs, you follow your airway, breathing, circulation, you follow all the steps that you're taught. More than that, we are taught stabilization of many different kinds of injuries that can happen, particularly out in the wilderness. falls, impacts, broken bones, dislocation, lacerations. So that can also inform what you carry in your first aid kit. So it's not just Band-Aids. It's not just cleaning out a wound, but it could be something even more than that, like somebody's mental state. We're taught to deal with people's mental state, group mental status, heat exhaustion, hypothermia, hyperthermia, you name it. And it's even in a two-day course, all of those things can be taught how to stabilize somebody. But again, going back to that beginning is, how do I assess the situation? How do I make it safe for myself? How do I make it safe for my patient? And how do I properly assess them? How do I go through very rigorously the steps, 1, 2, 3, and 4, A, B, C, D, E, that they've taught me to assess a patient to see if they're breathing and where the problems are, and not just to come up on somebody and whip their helmet off and assume that they don't have a back injury or a neck injury. The wilderness first aid is very specific to certain types of outdoor injuries.
Well, one of the things that I always taught when I was teaching motorcyclist first aid, because even if I'm talking to people who ride on pavement, we traditionally as motorcyclists seek those roads that are less traveled, that are twisty, that are up in the mountains, that are down in canyons, that may not have cell service. They may not be near anything. And one of the revelations to me, I was riding with a couple of riders. This was quite a few years ago. And one of the riders at the tail of the group, we were on pavement on a street ride, and we were up in one of the national forests, and a rider had an error. He made a mistake and he went down, and it almost cost him his life. He ended up very, very severely injured with a broken hip, punctured lung, just really bad. In fact, when I went into the ditch to find him, I thought he was done. But the reason I bring this up is we were on pavement and we were less than an hour from a town. And it was 5 hours before he saw the inside of a hospital. And we weren't very far from Portland, Oregon, which is a major city. And he arrived in Portland by helicopter. That was on the pavement. And you know what riders don't always realize is that you can't call for help. And if we're adventure riders, we're on trails or roads where they don't necessarily have the ability to drive up to us. In our case, we had to wave down a car to get them to drive down the mountain, to call the volunteer fire department so they could come in to get their rig, to drive it up the mountain, to package them up, to drive them back down the mountain, to put them in the helicopter, to fly them to the hospital. And it was terrifying to be there. And I am a former EMT, and I train people to do this. And watching somebody die in front of you and going, there's nothing I can do, is absolutely a terrifying experience. And I don't want anybody to ever be in that same situation.
Right. That definitely goes back to that situational awareness. If you come onto a scene, there's other people around and you can have them do other things and help you. You can have them calling 911. You can have somebody go out and try and find help if you have the luxury of having multiple people. You can have somebody on the head stabilizing the head while you do the rest of your trunk checks. So it's all those things are taught to you in the wilderness first aid, is how do you marshal whatever resources you have around you to aid in the rescue of this injured person.
But what do we do if, and this is so common, there's only two of us? You and I go out on a ride and I make a mistake. You know, something bad happens. I catch a rut wrong. You know, we know how fast things can happen no matter how good you are. And there's no cell service and we're up on a trail and there's no way to get help unless you leave me. What are you going to do?
That's a tough one. That's a really tough one. The best thing I tell people is carry a personal locator beacon. I carry an InReach SE Plus. It has two-way texting. I think that anybody who goes into the backcountry should have some sort of a personal locator beacon on them. That doesn't necessarily totally mitigate me having to leave you in a rescue situation. The bottom line is you never leave a patient who needs you, who needs your treatment. And that's rescue 101. You can't leave an unconscious patient in the middle of the woods, no matter what. You just have to hope that either.
So you let them, and that's, and here's where we're getting into some tough realities. So Jesse, you know, I travel international. I travel in places where if I hit the beacon, nobody's coming.
Right.
Nobody's going to come to me. I have to get them out. I ride in places where if I wait for somebody to figure out how to come up the trail, that person's going to be dead before they get there. If they're injured and I can't move them and they have a life-threatening injury and I just wait, nobody's coming down the trail. Nobody's going to find us. No car's going to drive by. you're going to have, mountaineering is the same way. You can't stay. You have to get help.
I mean, you touch on a basic subject here. Do you stay with the person? Do you just, if you're talking about breaking it down to brass tacks, if they're going to die anyway, and you leave them unconscious and you go to get help, you know, it's six of one, half a dozen of another. Are you going to be successful? Are you going to get injured trying to go get help? Is help going to come back in time? Weighing the value of somebody's life is very difficult. And if you're the one that has to make that decision, it's a very personal decision. And for me personally, I'm not sure if I would make the decision to leave an unconscious patient in the wild and try and go get help. As you're so fond of saying, it depends. It depends on so many different factors. You know, am I an hour away from the town that we just passed? Am I 50 miles from anywhere? Am I in the middle of Mongolia and it's 200 kilometers to nowhere? It really depends on the situation.
These are the questions that people have to weigh in their head. Are they ready for that? Can they deal with that? Because, you know, one of the things we have to accept,
yeah, we have to accept that this is an inherently dangerous thing that we do.
Well, obviously it's inherently dangerous, but none of us want to die for it. You know, that's not our goal. You know, and I know one thing's, I know when I teach riders, and this was true for on-road as well, because a lot of the paved roads that I trained riders for, not just talking the off-road, I looked at them and said, when will help come? And if you have to, if you know that if you stay here, they're going to die. If you leave and get help, they might die. That's that whole triage thing of going, right. Do I go with the guaranteed they die or do I try to get help? And the things that I brought up to people is go, look, here's the thing that makes mountaineering or wilderness or adventure first aid so different. When I'm doing basic first aid on the street, I have 3 to 5 minutes before somebody shows up for help when I call them. When we're out on the trail, it may be hours. It might take me hours just to get out to get a cell service, never mind get the actual help. And if it takes me 2 hours out, that's 2 hours back. That's for me knowing where they're at. And rescue may take even longer. And I may have to stay there to show them where to go, depending what things are. And I say, look, you got to have a plan. You got to stop. You've got to stabilize the rider the best you can. Make them as safe as possible. Put a shelter over them. Make them secure. Wrap them up. Treat them for shock. Do all the things you have to do to give them the best chance of survival. And then don't rush away. Take a GPS note. Look for landmarks to know exactly where they're at. Leave things so it's easy to see them. Put bright clothing out where it's easy to see from the sky, where it's out in the middle of the trail. Leave their bike where it can be seen.
Right, lay the bike down. Yeah.
Yeah, and leave a note. I carry tape with a large white tape, and I don't use it most of the time for medical to tape people up. I do it so I can write notes on it and leave it with the rider. So a person knows that I went for help when I left, when that rider went down, any pertinent information that I can leave behind, because if somebody else comes up on them, I don't want them to go chasing down the mountain to look for help. I'm already doing that. I want them to stay with them if possible. So I leave messages behind. So if we're lucky enough that somebody else comes across the person I'm riding with, the friend that I left behind, the family member that's there, that somebody's going to stop and help them through this or help them stay alive while I'm trying to get help for the same reason.
Right. Again, that goes back to what do you carry and why do you carry it? What's in your kit? Why do you have it? Assess your kit, measure it against other people and what they have in their kit. Go online and ask the professionals what they carry. And, you know, you're going to get 1,000 answers. It's almost as big as a discussion as tires and oil, maybe not quite so much, but there's definitely variations about what people carry in their first aid kits.
Well, I carry something different if it's just me on the trail versus if it's myself and somebody traveling internationally. And I'm rebuilding my kit now for Nepal, and I've got 10 riders. And if something happens to anybody, they're going to turn and look at me.
Right.
And I'm not counting on my guides to have what we need. I'm not counting on the local medical, if there is any, to have what they need. So obviously that kid's going to be much more significant than what I carry locally, where I might be able to call a cell phone, where it's a minor injury that I'm trying to deal with. So here's the question for you. Since you get into the question of what do you pack, what do you carry? If you had somebody come up to you and say, look, I'm an adventure rider. I'm going to go out and take that first aid class. I'm going to go take a mountaineering class or buy a book and just study up on this. What are you going to recommend they carry if they're going out doing some of the BDRs, the backcountry discovery routes, or the TAT, or a similar type of adventure? in maybe northern Mexico, Canada, you know, North America, what would you suggest they keep in their kit? Would you buy one? Would you build one? What would you do?
I would buy a basic kit and then upgrade it. Most of the kits, the adventure kits, are pretty good these days, and they're becoming more and more refined. And of course, they give you the full list of what's included in the kit. A nice 3-inch by 6-inch by 5-inch zippered pack is pretty nice. You can stuff a lot of extra stuff in there. I carry most of the basics, bandages, triangle bandages, so you can bandage arms and immobilize limbs. It's good for splinting. I carry, of course, gauze. I carry saline solution. As riders, sometimes we get things in our eyes, dust. So a packet of saline solution is good. I carry a SAM splint, which is aluminum covered with foam. I carry the long one, so that's good for immobilizing and splinting. And you can use these things for all sorts of things. I carry 50 feet of twine. I carry electrolyte tabs for treating people who are dehydrated. I carry honey sticks for diabetics. Certainly lots of nitrile gloves to keep your fluids separate from my fluids. I also carry a blood clot bandage. There's lots of cases of adventure riders getting skewered on sticks and all sorts of things. So you never know when you have a puncture that you want to stop the bleeding. So, you know, a good blood clot bandage as well. And most of that you can fit in a relatively small space. And that's pretty much what I carry.
And I think that covers most of the basics. I think the challenge for me is when I have a larger group, what exactly will I need when I need all of it? And so I don't have to carry everything all the time, but I just want the things I need when I need them.
That's
of course, always the hope. And for international stuff and even local, I carry a fair bit of pharmaceutical all over the counter. I don't carry anything that I'm not authorized to have. And I did a blog on this. If somebody goes to the website, they'll find it. And I created a menu of drugs. It turns out when you go to the drugstore and you look at all the different stuff for your headache and what if I have a headache and an earache and what if, and you go on down the line, that all of these are just combinations of a few basic drugs. And what I did was I dissected what the amount was in each combination. And I wrote that down going, if it's this ailment, this is the combination that the manufacturers put out there. And I created a menu so that I carry the basic drugs, the Tylenol, the just these core drugs, and then depending on the ailment, I mix them the same way that the pharmaceutical companies do. And that seems to work very, very, very well. And traveling international, one of the things that riders may not recognize, one, some of the drugs you may put in your kit that you think are nothing special can be a big deal if you go in the wrong country. One of those is diphenhydramine. There are countries that you might as well be going across the American border carrying crack cocaine. It's the same thing. You'll end up in prison, seriously.
Yeah.
And you know, it's very important to know what the laws are on the other side, but also you may not be able to find these drugs, or you may not recognize them because they use different names or different combinations, or it's just not written in English. You're not sure what you're getting. So certainly building a kit or building up your kit to have those sort of things with you is not a bad idea. That's certainly something I would throw out and suggest to riders. And then also you brought up the triangular bandages and all of these, which are universal. I love them. You can block bleeding with them. You can splint people. You can tie things together. You can fix a windshield with it. You know, whatever. They're just really useful.
Yep.
But also looking that we travel, I'm not going to necessarily carry a blanket, a reflective blanket always, because I also have a tent and I have sleeping bags and I have other gear. They have riding gear. And so you start going, okay, what am I going to need that I can't purpose from the kit that we use when we travel?
Yeah. Yep. Tent poles can be used as splints. Pieces of a ground cloth can be used to wrap somebody up. We call it the human burrito. If somebody gets cold, stuff them in a sleeping bag and wrap them in a ground cloth to keep them warm. And that's another thing that those wilderness first aid classes teach you is, what are my resources? What can I use? If you're backpacking, it's one set of things. But if you're on your motorcycle and you've got a lot of other gear with you, your menu of other things that you can use to help somebody increases greatly. Another medicine that was suggested to me was dye-free Benadryl, because a lot of people are allergic to the red dye in a lot of the standard Benadryl. So the dye-free Benadryl was another interesting one that somebody mentioned recently.
Huh. Yeah, I've never heard that one. I just made a note of that. That's awesome. Yeah. Now, have you dealt with any altitude sickness? I mean, we're when we talk about the BDRs, you go through Colorado, you're going to be over 14,000 feet. I'm going into Nepal. Those are not insane altitudes. We're only going to be up around, I think our maximum is 13,000. But also when I was down in South America, we camped at 16,000 feet down in Bolivia. And we had coca leaves. We could always make coca tea and that worked great. But we don't exactly have coca leaves laying around most of the time here in the States. What do you recommend, or do you have a recommendation?
Being from the Northeast, we really don't have tall mountains out here. I don't have experience with altitude sickness. The one time that I did get to high altitude was doing the TAT last year and going through the Colorado passes and riding some bits in Utah, which were above 10, 11,000 feet. But the only time I felt short of breath was when we went over Imogene Pass, and it was over 13,000 feet, and we were really working to get to the top. And I just felt a little lightheaded and a little short of breath, but yeah, we didn't spend a whole lot of time up there, that's for sure. So, you know, it was like, oh, take a picture. All right, let's get the hell out of here. I don't have a whole lot of experience with altitude sickness.
Yeah, altitude is something special. We don't necessarily think that we're going to be affected. I was down, when we were down in that trip down to South America, by the time I got back, it had only been about 6 months since I'd been camping at 16,000 feet. And I went over to Colorado. Well, I live down near Seattle, Tacoma area. So we're at sea level. Like you, we're pretty low to the ground. My air is thick. I went over to Colorado Springs and we went up to the Pikes Peak up there, and it's just over 14,000 feet. And I got off the bike and the other two riders started gasping and grasping their chest. And I'm thinking, well, of course, I'll be cool about this whole thing. And I got off and my head started spinning. I said, okay, guys, if you can't walk around, fine. I'll just sit down with you. You're like a couple of pussies that you are. And I'm like, I'm not taking another step. You know, I'm not going to tell them. But yeah, it happens very, very quickly. And the only real solution is getting down to a lower altitude, but that's not always an option right away. And I guess, the thing I would throw out to anybody listening to this is, when you do build your aid kit, or when you do look for what kind of skills you need, really consider the environments you're going into that you may not be accustomed to. If you're going to go up to Alaska, that's a very different terrain than if you're from the Northeast. Altitude, cold, wilderness, how far away you are from people, and focus on those potential scenarios, the stuff we don't want to think about ever happening to us or somebody that we're riding with.
When we were preparing for our TAT ride, that was definitely a consideration. Scotty and I are both from the Northeast. We're both from New England, and we knew we were going to be going through the higher elevations. And then after Colorado, man, it's all desert until you get up into Oregon again. So crossing the desert was definitely something we were aware of. Our preparation was as simple as making sure that we were fully covered. Scotty's very light skinned, so he had sunscreen with him. We had plenty of extra water. We made sure we didn't push ourselves. We kept an eye on each other. So it's not just what you bring with you. It's the mental preparation as well that's very important for those different environments. Like you said, if you're from the Northeast and you're going to Alaska, yeah, your mindset needs to be a little different about what you're preparing.
I think we're blending into what I focus on the most, which is less about fixing things when they happen and what to do to prevent those from happening. As you know, as a trainer, I get a lot of riders come to me and a lot of different health, age, previous concerns, riding skill, motorcycles, and it's a very high risk environment for me for that. And luckily, as I mentioned, my medical gear is all expired again, and that's a good thing. But it's about having that realization. And one of the nice things I like about working with adventure riders is they're generally older riders. You know, they're going to be in my age bracket. They're going to be in their 50s. They're going to be in their 40s. They're going to be in their 60s. And these are people who are sort of past the bravado. They're much more likely to say, yeah, I'm hot. I need to cool off. Or I'm tired. I need a break. And of course, I time that stuff. I try to make sure we only ride so far, that we have a good place with the breeze, that we have food, that we have water, that people are taking those essential breaks, and I control the time. And a lot of times people want to ride more. And I'm like, yep, we're done for the day. And they're like, okay, we just want to keep going. And about 25 minutes later, they go, yeah, we're done. They don't realize it. They don't know. And that's really a challenge to do that, to recognize those beforehand. I train instructors here, and my main job is training street riders and street instructors. And I talk to them about how to pay attention to the riders. Don't just look at what they're riding or how they're riding, but were they attentive and intermixed in all the conversation early on, and then do they become quiet? That's a sign. Look at their eyes. Are they spacing out where they used to be attentive? That's a sign. Are you looking? Are they holding themselves like they're cold? Are they cradling things? Are they moving slow to get on and off the bike where before they weren't moving as slow? And recognizing these patterns and being able to address them before something bad happens. Because when something bad happens, no matter what the scenario is or whatever the solution is, it's never good. The fact that something bad happened puts it in the bad category.
Right. Very often I find myself going to rallies and being the sweep rider very often, because everybody knows I have the training. Everybody knows I carry the full kit. And that observational skill is definitely something that takes practice. But when you're watching everybody from behind, you know, and where they are in the morning and how they're negotiating obstacles, and you're getting in the afternoon, they're getting tired, and putting those observational skills to the test and saying, hey, you're looking a little tired. I see you kind of fell over on that rock. How are you feeling? And you say trying to intervene before something really bad happens, but being exceptionally observant to the whole group.
Yeah, the guy that jumps up and grabs a bike and tries to throw it up, he's the guy I'm worried about. The guy that wants to just shake it off and he's I'm good, I'm fine. Those are the guys I worry about. I want people who are going to be humble. I want to walk up to a rider and say, hey, you know, you look like you're pretty beat on this. You've given it three shots going up this hill. Why don't I take your bike to the top and meet at the top, finish the ride? And when the riders are like, no, I'm going to do this. My goal is to train them to, but at some points there are real limits. It could be their bike. It could be their physical condition. It could be their exhaustion level. But we have to recognize what those limits are. Not every rider can. And that's important when you're managing this. And again, I think most of the riders who are listening to this probably ride with one rider, you know, one other rider most of the time, maybe a second rider, sometimes solo, but most riders seem to go out with one buddy. And the realization that you might have to leave your buddy behind, that's tough.
Yeah, it's a tough calculation for sure.
All right. So let me ask, what are your top tips? If you were to tell somebody, all right, if nothing else, this is what you need to know, what are you going to send them off with right here?
I would say get at least the 2-day wilderness first aid training, either from the SOLO, the Stonehearth Open Learning Opportunities, or from Knowles, the National Outdoor Leadership School. So they're the two big ones. And take their 2-day trainings. They're not that expensive. They're offered throughout the country, everywhere. Think about where you're riding. Think about what your skill set is. Think about what you're bringing for first aid. We think a lot about our bikes and what we need to fix our bikes, but we need to think about what we need to fix our bodies. You know, our bodies on a ride are an extension of our bikes. So we need to be able to fix them as well as we need to fix our bikes. And having that knowledge, like you say, the knowledge to change a tire, the knowledge to patch an engine and keep moving is as critical as it is for our bodies. Know how to use what you're carrying with you. Know how to have a rescue plan and discuss it with your group. Very often we discuss, okay, who's got the 10 millimeter wrench? Who's got the air compressor? Who's got the spare tubes? Well, I want to know who's got the triangle bandages and who's got the SAM splint and who's got what kind of training. If you go to rallies, you don't know who you're riding with. And these accidents can happen 10 minutes from home. They can happen 10 miles from home. You have no idea. So just really thinking about where you're riding, what you're prepared for, and discussing it with your group. Those are the biggest ones. And get a personal locator beacon. That's the other one. If you compare the cost of getting a personal locator beacon to a lot of the other accessories we have for our bikes, they're pretty gosh darn cheap, and they can offer an awful lot.
And I think you touched on two of the ones I would definitely throw out, and I'm just going to reinforce this. You mentioned about knowing your kit, knowing your materials. I kind of make the same suggestion you do. Buy a kit that's ready made, but don't stop there. Take that kit out and lay everything out. And if you don't know how to use something in that kit, then either toss it out or learn how to use it.
Right.
Because sometimes it's not something you want. It's not ideal for your situation. And then build that kit with the things that you do have, that you do need, that you're going to use, that you know how to use. So make that kit personalized. And the other thing that you touched on that I think is important, I don't assume I'm the guy that knows the most. I'm probably not. As I reach out to all these riders, that's what I find out as well. I want to know what their medical background is, because if anything happens, I want to be able to help them. But also, I want to know what their medical training is. And I've got former military medics. I have guys that are combat medic trained. I have guys with experience. I have former EMTs. These guys are on the trip with me. I want to know what those skill sets are so I know who to tap into or when I should be tapping out because somebody else is better qualified, more experienced, and can do a better job. And that frees me up to do those other things that I might be able to do better. Maybe my best job is going to get help and their job is to take care of them. Other times, maybe I should stay with the patient or the rider that's down and somebody else should go get help. And I think that's a really, really important thing to do is to know the people you're with and to know the stuff and the equipment that you have with you.
Exactly. That's part of marshaling your resources and knowing what you have available to you.
Well, thank you so much, Jesse, for coming on to Around the Wheel and sharing your knowledge and your experience with all the listeners. The goal of this podcast is to be educational, to make a difference, and to reach out to other riders so that we can all be better at what we do and enjoy the sport all the more. And the last parting thought, if you're on the Patreon page, the sticker that says Smile While You Ride, Attitude Matters. Remember, we chose to go all of those places that we chose to go. So when you're wet, when you're cold, when you're miserable, just remember, you're the one that chose to do that. And if you're smiling, it makes it so much better because we have to stay positive. And when you have a negative attitude, when things are going bad, it doesn't get any better. And when we're talking about medical, if something bad goes down, we have to have the right attitude. It doesn't mean we have to be laughing and smiling, but we need to keep positive and we need to keep forging forward. Thanks for listening to Around the Wheel. Keep riding, stay safe, smile while you ride.